WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. California voters have sent the most women to Congress, followed by New York. Four states, including Delaware, have never elected a woman to either the U.S. Senate or House. Women candidates haven't fared very well in Pennsylvania, and that's certainly true after the May primary, when gubernatorial candidates Alison Schwartz and Kathleen McGinty were beaten by Democrat Tom Wolf. Locally, women candidates lost in the 8th and 13th congressional districts, and even though they are a majority of voters, they are a minority in the state legislature. So why do women candidates struggle for support in the Commonwealth? And does it matter? We have two guests joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Karen Heller. She's a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been writing about this. And Karen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Her research focuses on gender, money, and campaign strategy. And Kelly Dittmar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Karen, let me begin with you. How much do you personally consider the gender of a candidate when you think about voting or think about who you might support?
That's a good question. I mean, I always vote for the candidate I like the most, and in many cases, I don't even have a choice. It's a man. All the people who represent me right now are male. But the fewer women there are, the more you have to give a consideration that we'll have no women in Congress come January.
And does that concern you?
It concerns me greatly.
To you, Kelly, why do you think Pennsylvania is unrepresented when it comes to women in elective office? What's your analysis?
I think there are some things in Pennsylvania that challenges for women that are mirrored throughout the country. So things that women candidates face in the piece that Karen wrote recently, questions about their qualifications, their likability, stereotypes that face women, face them throughout the country. But I think sometimes it's amplified depending on the culture of a state and the precedent of having women in office. So in Pennsylvania, you have this sort of conflicting and amplifying factor that you already don't have a lot of women in leadership. So we have less than 20% in the legislature, only one woman in statewide office, and a not very long and small history of women in Congress from Pennsylvania. So those role models for women's leadership and the ability for women to get into the political power structures in the state has been limited. So I think you have the existing stereotypes that we see face women candidates amplified due to culture, precedent, and also parties. We know in New Jersey, where we're based, parties play a big role in recruiting and supporting candidates, and I think that's true in Pennsylvania as well. And parties can be a particular barrier to women because they continue to be dominated by men.
Karen, let me ask you about the Alison Schwartz candidacy. And I think a year ago, people felt like, based on her bio, her many years in Congress, her presence here in the Philadelphia region, that she would win the primary last month. Obviously, she was beaten out by Tom Wolf. Using her, I guess, as a sort of a crystal ball to understand about women in politics, how do you see her candidacy?
Well, she is actually the exception to what was just said, that she did have party support. She was supported by the party leaders in Philadelphia. And there I have written that she was not a great candidate. But the reaction to her being a great candidate is not the same as being an able politician or perhaps a successful governor. But the reaction was so personal and vindictive. The email, the comments, about her likability, about her, how attractive she was. Nobody wrote this about Tom Wolf. Tom Wolf is very likable, and that's, one of the great strategies of his campaign. He ran a great campaign, but he had $10 million of his own money. So,
and an early head start.
Very early head start. And clearly there was bad strategic planning. She didn't get good advice. She didn't take good advice, whatever. And yes, that's true. But there was also another woman in that race, too.
Indeed, Kathleen McGinty.
Yes. And I think she is. And what I wrote on in Wednesday's column is that these two women are very different. And in fact, there were five very different women. And to lump them all together, which I wrote a second column because people just wanted to make them all the same. We don't lump men together. So, if they'll say this about one candidate, it may not be true of the other. And yet they all lost. And Kathleen McGinty, who I thought was a terrific candidate, she didn't have a lot of money, so she couldn't go on the air here until very late. But she is very different from Allison. The criticism was Allison Schwartz was a career politician, then Katie McGinty is a career policy person. If the you have to say something happened here. It's just not enough to say one person was a bad candidate.
Let me go back to you, Kelly. But do you think when voters, and this is obviously broadly speaking, but when voters go into that little booth to vote, do you think this issue of gender and whether a candidate is a male or female, does that play large for them?
We know that from the research, women win their races at the same rate as men in comparable contests based on things like competitiveness, party, et cetera. So when they get to the ballot box, voters are far less likely to be considering gender. They're far more likely to be considering party ID or ideology. But I think that the questions that are raised to women along the way, before they get to the ballot, before they get to the ballot box in terms of voters, those are the things that we are concerned about in terms of the gender dynamics of a race. So if questions are raised about likability, if questions or media coverage focuses on appearance, or different sorts of smaller things happen along the way that are gendered, those are the ways, I think, in which gender influences the campaign. So it's less so when you get to election day, but what are the things along the way that may have shaped voters' evaluations of a candidate? And those are the things that you have to pay attention to.
Go ahead, Karen, you want to say something?
Yeah, and that's, I wrote about this, but Philadelphia Magazine in December, which, you know, crucial kind of fundraising time, wrote a story, Who Doesn't Like Allison Schwartz is the headline, and the subhead is A Lot of People, and it opens with a reporter confronting Allison Schwartz. This is the beginning of the article, that no one likes her, and she had to respond, and she got up, and you know, it was over. And this is exactly what happened with Hillary Clinton in a debate in New Hampshire in 2008, when they talked about how extremely bright and capable and what a good senator, but a poll in New Hampshire had said she wasn't likable, and that's the famous line, you're likable enough, you know, Hillary.
That Obama said, right.
And who asks that of, let's talk about candidates, other candidates like John Kerry or Dick Cheney or Arlen Specter was somebody I brought who was served Pennsylvania longer than anyone, and he was not
Arlen.
And you know, nobody but really smart, and nobody questioned. It was like, that's fine for a man, or his looks. That's fine for a man, and yet I'm getting email about how unattractive all these candidates are. So it's like locker room, middle school, gender politics still going on. It's amazing.
Go ahead, Kelly.
To add in that what we know too is that not only is that in terms of watching it sort of annoys us all, but we know that it actually matters for voters. So there's been some great research done by the Barbara Lee Family Foundation and a group called Name It Change, and they've looked at things like likability and the effect of sexist coverage on evaluations of women candidates. And one thing that they found was that likability for women is tied to voters' perceptions of their qualifications to lead. Mm. So if they're not seen as likable, they're also not seen as qualified to be governor, to be a member of Congress, and all of those things. For men, their likability isn't tied to that. So Arlen Specter can be, you know, the mean guy. Exactly, and he can win his race. We saw this in New York with Christine Quinn and questions about, the New York Times did a whole profile about how likable she was in the mayoral race. And so it's not only a difference in coverage, it also affects how voters perceive that candidate, and that's proven by the research. So I think that there's a secondary piece of this, which is that it actually, the media and other folks, the way in which women are covered, really does have an impact, again, on voter support along the way, and raises questions that women have to answer to that men don't.
And it seems as if Allison Schwartz really did feel as if the coverage that she got had a sexist tinge to it, Karen.
I don't know. I don't think that, I would say that the Inquirer was really fair in this issue. And you know, just going to what Kelly said about Christine Quinn and New York, and she did not run a good campaign, but she's following Michael Bloomberg. I mean, this is one of the least charming people you can imagine in politics, but very effective. And, you know, he changed the law so he could run and win for a third term. So, again, you have that. And I just want to get back. I mean, I got over 100 emails, the phone. I haven't even listened to all the voicemail. But I wanted to say that...
In response to your article.
In response to my article. And I wrote two, because the first one, I wanted to stress not just Alison Schwartz, but also Katie McGinty, who I thought was a terrific candidate, who is extremely likable, very charming, the only person in the last few weeks who took the high road, who refused to attack Tom Wolf. And all the other candidates, I think, liked her for it. And Shaughnessy Naughton, Val Arcouche, these are in every way attractive candidates. Mm. If that is important, that they're good-looking, and pleasant. So I wanted to, two things. So here's an email I got. This is the most severe, but not unusual. He said, however, I'm a man, and I admittedly would only vote for a woman if she was attractive. Just being honest, I suspect if Katie McGinty, for instance, looked like a typical cable news babe, she wouldn't have come in last. Alison Schwartz, let's face it, is hideously ugly. So is Hillary Clinton. And then when I asked if I could quote him, he said, well, you have to take that part out. And then the other thing I really want to get to, which really is a core issue, a lot of people wrote, seriously, if more women had voted, these candidates would have won. And that is locker room politics, because, frankly, we've all voted for men because we haven't had a choice. And many women I know struggled because when Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama, and they voted for Obama, and they felt he would be just as good a president for them as Hillary Clinton. So that is not how women vote, but the assumption that men won't vote for women, this is huge, and it's out there. I think you're right. When they get to the polls, if they're there and they know them and they like them, they will vote. But the money raising, I have a chart here of how little money Katie McGinty, who I thought was great, she received less than 8% of the vote.
That's right.
And she couldn't get on television because she didn't have the money. And they had to spend a lot of time raising money, and it is a male network. There have been a lot written about how, oddly, the most progressive, we think of the Northeast as being progressive, and yet it's not a great track record for women being elected. They do far better in sort of pioneer states, New Hampshire, you know, people where women just early on had presence and power in all sorts of facets of life. You know, California, the West, and, you know, our state is the worst in our region, but Massachusetts only elected its first woman senator, Elizabeth Warren, in 2012. So that's Massachusetts we're talking about.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Karen Heller. She's a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she's been writing about the primary, the fact that two women candidates lost the primary here in Pennsylvania, also a couple of local races where women did lose as well. Kelly Dittmar is with us, and she's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. And we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or were the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
Next time on The Pulse, a topic we've been talking about a lot.
Bao him square.
Dao chu okle dao got.
Mandam na ibian na.
Jamai amakan.
What?
Health insurance.
Health insurance.
In Burmese.
Current language.
Vietnamese.
immigrants, and the Affordable Care Act, benefits and challenges.
The same representative to speak with a marketplace representative.
She don't speak English well.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The two women running in last month's Democratic primary for Pennsylvania governor lost, as did four women running for Congress in local races here in the Philadelphia area. Does this say anything about gender and politics in the Commonwealth? Were they just the wrong candidates at the wrong time? We're talking about this with Karen Heller, a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Kelly Dittmar with the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just play an excerpt from an ad, actually, by the Democratic gubernatorial candidate Allison Schwartz, where she criticizes the male hold on Harrisburg in one of her campaign ads. Let's listen.
We do all know that the old boys club exists in Harrisburg. I have to tell you that it is holding us back and it is hurting us. Because when they get together and all have whatever drinks they have, they're not talking about us. They're not talking about you. They're talking about how to look out for each other, protect the status quo, and it's going to take someone who knows how to break those barriers and do things differently.
And again, that's an excerpt of an ad. It goes on longer than that. Kelly, was that a good ad?
You know, I think it was a sort of fascinating ad. It's the first time, really, that we've seen somebody run at that level of office and take a whole ad to dedicate to challenging the boys' club. And I think what's effective about the ad is that it resonates particularly with women who feel this is the case, that the men are in charge and they're outsiders to the political system. And it also does what some literature and some research has suggested would be beneficial to women candidates, which is when there's a problem of gender and gender disparity, call it out. Call it out and get voters to see that something needs to change and you, in fact, are that catalyst for change. The challenge for Allison Schwartz in doing an ad like that, however, is that people couldn't really see her as change because she'd been in Congress so long and there was such a negative view of Congress. So I think it could work. That message could work. I think the challenge she had was her resume, her time there, and secondly, the fact that she didn't have enough money to get it out.
I was saying to Karen, I'll say it to it now to you now on the air, which is that I was imagining, though, being just a regular guy in my car or watching TV at home and seeing that ad and feeling like, I'm not part of a boys' club. I'm just a schlub that goes to work and comes home, and I'm trying to support my family. I wonder whether I'm looking at you, Karen. Obviously, whether there could be also a kind of a downside to an ad like that.
Possibly, although that is to attract women to get to the polls. And as we know, I got a lot of emails saying if only more women had voted, again, that women vote for women and men will not vote for women. But the fact is that the turnout was so horrible. It was horrible in almost all primaries. It was 1 in 5 registered Democrats voted. So it was terrible. And we don't know the exit poll, but we can pretty much assume it was probably 50-50. Mm-hmm. And so, again, women don't have to vote for women, but the assumption is that men don't vote for women. And that ad is designed. Kathleen Kane did use the same strategy, and it worked for her. Now, it worked for her because she was a prosecutor, and she was replacing, basically, Tom Corbett, who had told women to close their eyes when they were going after reproductive rights and getting harsher standards for getting an abortion. So that worked for her, and it also came after, the whole Sandusky. She was a reaction. Often people are voted in as a reaction to what was before, and she couldn't have been less like Tom Corbett in that regard. But it is really important to note when we look at women I was just talking about that there have only been, we really have to take the long picture, and everybody wants to talk just about Allison Schwartz, and it's just so much bigger than that. In the history of Pennsylvania, we've only sent 7 women to Congress, and 3 of them replaced their husbands in special elections after they died. We are the 6th most populous state in the nation. Texas has a better record than we do. South Carolina has a Republican woman of color. I mean, the list goes on and on. We do have Kathleen Kane as Attorney General. And in terms of your center ranking, when I first started writing about this in 2006, we were 47th in the nation. I mean, we were like down there with Mississippi. Louisiana was better, I think. And now I'm happy to say we're 38th.
But moving up in the
world. We are moving up. But, you know, Rebecca Traister, who's written about this and is actually from this region, she says that, and the New York Times had an article, the Northeast is just not that great about it. And progressive politics, partly it's that the machines are male-dominated. Asking for money is, if you don't have experience, again, the more women that are present, it is a boys' club. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. But the more that women learn how to ask for money, which we know is unfortunately a huge part of politics, the better everyone is going to, you know, I think they're going to fare. And I, when I wrote that we will have no women, Pennsylvania will have no women in Congress, of 18 representatives, no women, people aren't shocked by that. I think that's shocking. And they go, well, you're just gender politics. And I'm going, but it's not representative of the state.
Kelly, let me go back to you, and only because you're across the river in New Jersey, and New Jersey and Pennsylvania are different in so many ways, including on this issue, I think, of gender and politics as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, why do you think that is?
You know, I think it's interesting. In some ways, we're the same. So we're one of 15 states currently that has no women in Congress. So sadly, we're used to the same story that Pennsylvania is looking forward to after January. We're thankful that it looks like we will actually have a woman elected to Congress after this cycle, after the primaries yesterday. But you know, we've had some success at the state legislative level here in New Jersey, and part of that is because I want to give a little credit to the work we've done here at the Center for American Women in Politics, which is that we've tried to build that support infrastructure. We mentioned money and the importance of money. We've tried to build a training infrastructure, a recruitment structure for women, and support networks so that they, if they are considering running, both we encourage them to do so and then provide them the support that they need. We confront the problem of political parties pretty severely here, and so we've had to really work with the parties and try to get them to recognize the problem of the dearth of women in office and really try to prioritize that as an issue. And I think that across the board in states where women are struggling to get into office, no matter what level, working with those political power structures, both getting women into them, but also raising to them the issue of gender disparity as a significant issue, not only for fairness, but also for the way policies are made and the way the political process works, is really an important point.
And that's Kelly Dittmar, who joins us along with Karen Heller. We're talking about women in politics. Let me get Christine from Society Hill to join our conversation. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm on the National Board of the Women's Campaign Fund, and I'm very close to all of these issues, and I so appreciate your talking about them this morning.
Sure.
And I appreciate Karen's comments. Yes, by the way, we're 38th in the country right now, but that's only because several states have gone down. It isn't that Pennsylvania is doing that much better. It's only relative to the rest of the states that we are. I appreciate your comment also about not blaming the candidates. This is an issue that there's got to be. I always tell people that this is more like the difference between weather and climate change. One storm, two storms does not mean the climate is changing. But when the storms continue to happen, something else is going on. And when we rank so poorly, something else is going on. And we need to bring about some climate change here in Pennsylvania.
Well, that's interesting.
And that's an interesting metaphor.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the other point I wanted to bring up, and I think it's a really clear one you're making, and that's that until we have a truly representative democracy where all of our elected officials represent all different kinds of Americans, we're going to continue to have laws passed like the one the other day where the State House in Pennsylvania voted to put In God We Trust on buildings. You know, 95% of Pennsylvanians believe in some form of gun registration or gun control, but we don't seem to be able to talk about about these issues because our representatives in elected office do not really represent Pennsylvanians and do not represent the feelings of Pennsylvanians.
Christine, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think that raises several issues. One is if people don't vote, and as you said, Karen, about 20% of people bothered to vote in the primary.
That's registered Democrats.
Registered Democrats, exactly. But also about money.
Right, and
what
I
cost to run for office. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say that I did call the National Republican Committee woman, and she never called me back, and I called three times. So I did reach out to Republicans as well. I think it's just a big issue. We just happen to be in races that were, Democratic challengers or in those races, or they were Democratic seats. I also want to say, what was just said about women's issues. There have been articles about how well the women in the Senate are working in both parties, and many people have commented that women are better at, I'm sorry to generalize, but listening, and that there has been more cooperation, particularly in the Senate, among Republican and Democratic women senators. And we're thrilled that it's 20% of the Senate. But I believe that sending more women of both parties will change not only what issues we're dealing with, but the dialogue. I just think that people behave differently when there is equal gender representation. We just know this in business. We know this in the military. It's just in everything. I'm not mandating it. I've gotten a lot of emails about that. I'm thinking, mandating it, we'll have zero in January.
You can't mandate anything anymore.
You're asking for one, and that's a problem. So just think that we're having this conversation. How many great, we have a woman president at Penn and, women leadership in so many places, and yet we are talking about this in 2014, and yet there's blowback that it's, that I'm griping, whining.
It's all about you, Karen.
but it's a girly thing. It's a locker room. Again, it's gym class,
Well, Kelly, even picking up what Karen just said, and apparently these women senators in Washington meet on a regular basis and talk about all these issues that seem to divide so much of Congress these days. It's an interesting sort of phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've done a lot of work on why women get into politics in the first place, because we're trying to get more of them, so we have to figure out what motivates them. And in our last survey of state legislators, we found that women's number one motivation in running for office is because they want to get things done, right? They have a policy issue they care about, and they want to affect change in the legislature. For men, the number one motivation to run for office was because they always wanted to be an elected official. So it's a much more power-based motivation. And so I think you actually see that in practice when you see women willing to work across the aisle, women willing to shut down the shutdown, right, in the Senate, because their motivation to be there is to make policy change. And I think that's a good thing. And I think, as Karen mentioned, it means that you need women from both parties in order to do it, because we often see women reaching across the aisle to each other. Not only are they changing that process and increasing the dialogue, and that matters, and we see that not only in the Senate, but it's in state legislatures and in other areas, although it is increasingly hard for them in the party-polarized areas, but they also raise questions about how policies are going to affect women, how they're going to affect marginalized communities, how they're going to affect children, because they bring a different perspective and experience. So, in a state of over 6 million women in Pennsylvania, it's a pretty sad state of affairs that only men will be speaking on their behalf in Washington, D.C., and it's a problem.
Go ahead, Karen. Then
I also want to say the school issue that's raging, and it's not just funding, by the way, for the Philadelphia schools. We're one of three states in the nation that does not have a fair funding formula. And in Harrisburg, women are only 8 out of 50 senators, and 37 of 203 in the House. I believe if there were more women of both parties, we would get a fair funding formula. We would stop. And it's just every city, small or large, in the state with a high percentage of poor people has this problem. And it's an embarrassment for our state. And I really believe that, again, if it's a mommy issue, it's a women's issue, fine, we need to fix it.
Let me get Larry from, looks like, Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Marty. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks. I was listening to your show, and I just wanted to make a comment.
Go ahead.
As far as Allison Schwartz goes, I was following that the primaries closely, and I liked her initially, but the fact is that she appeared to be very political.
Larry, let me just stop you there. Why? It sounds like that's a negative for you.
It is a negative for me, and the fact is that the first thing that she did coming out was that she attacked Tom Wolf instead of addressing issues that are probably a lot more important than him at that time. I think the attack, she immediately attacked rather than say what she stood for, exactly what she stood for, instead of having a broad brush and saying what all politicians seem to say today, try to cover as much territory politically as they can without being specific.
Okay.
I have to say I was very disappointed in her campaign, and to me it was almost like an old girls' club.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Larry, let me give Karen Heller has a look on her face. Go
ahead,
Karen.
Well, political is just an interesting thing to say about a politician, and in a lot of the mail that I've gotten from constituents say that she stopped serving me, she didn't come to some meeting, she didn't do some small constituent service, and yet I would think that's true of most of the male congressmen. And Katie McGinty, just to the other side, did never attack Tom Wolf. She took the high road. Nobody watched those debates. I think there was an exit poll that 6% paid attention to the debates. And in the early debates, before Tom Wolf was way ahead, she wasn't attacking him. And Rob McCord, by the way, who initially was a terrific candidate, he just flamed out by going after Tom Wolf over an absurd, a ridiculous issue. And he was far more virulent in his attacks than... I'm not apologizing for her, but I'm just saying that there's other issues here.
Larry, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have a tweet, actually just changed there. Besides myself, I can only name two other who voted in the primary. The good news that they were both women. This is an email that we had from Molly, and I think this is a problem, Kelly. Is if we're talking about women in politics, but if people don't vote, you end up having a very sort of perverted electoral system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that always when you can bring new folks to the polls, it's good for democracy, but it tends to be good for women as well, because folks who are looking at themselves potentially as outside the political system may also look to women candidates that way. I will say one thing about women voters is that we know that actually women are more reliable voters than men. They have outvoted men and outnumbered men in terms of registration since the 1980s. So it's not a surprise that we then see the candidates, particularly in primaries as well, but also then into the general election, trying to target women voters. And I think, as Karen mentioned earlier, that was part of the Schwartz strategy. It was a pretty clear strategy she had throughout the campaign, which was if we could get women who tend to be a strong Democratic base to the polls, that might help me. Of course, it wasn't enough in her race.
Karen, I'm giving you the final word, about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye.
Well, I know that there's a group, Represent, that is trying to get more women to the legislature. And I even though people said that's two columns too many, I really hope that voters look at representation and say, is this really, truly representative of this state, and is this progress?
Well, on that note, Karen Heller, thank you for joining us today on Radio Time. She's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you can read the two columns that she so bravely and boldly wrote about women in politics here in Pennsylvania. Kelly Dittmar, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And she's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. And do stay with us after this very short break. Yes, we are talking about bears in the burbs. That's coming up next. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Levitt Pavilion Steel Stacks supports WHYY and presents Playing for Change, June 12th at Steel Stacks in Bethlehem. Playing for Change, a concert and drum circle featuring 10 artists from around the globe, is supported in part by a National Endowment for the Arts Award, Artworks. There are 50 additional concerts at Levitt Pavilion this summer, including Coco Montoya, Badfinger, The Cowsills, Carbon Leaf, and more. No ticket required to attend. Details at levittsteelstacks.org.
The Thoroughbreds will be running in the Belmont Stakes Saturday with a potential Triple Crown winner in the field. On the next Fresh Air, Donna Barton Brothers, a former jockey with 1,100 wins, tells us about life at the track, being a TV analyst, and about her mom, who got into fights with male jockeys when she got into racing. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The lawmaker who represents the lawmakers, if they live in the District of Columbia.
The founders of our country would never have left anybody behind, and the very last people they meant to leave behind were the people who lived in what was become the nation's capital.
Eleanor Holmes Norton on her city on representative democracy and a dysfunctional Congress. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There have been a number of black bear sightings in suburban Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Bears have been turning up in people's backyards where they are snacking at the bird feeders or rifling through trash cans or even taking a dip in the pool. Well, we asked Kelly Burgess to join us. He's a principal biologist and black bear project leader with the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. And Kelsey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
And to our listeners, any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Kelsey, is this unusual to be seeing birds in the burbs?
Bears
in the burbs.
Unusual.
And why is that unusual?
It's not. Actually, it's becoming more and more of a commonplace. You know, we live in one of the most densely populated areas in our country here in this little tri-state region with Pennsylvania and New Jersey and whatnot, and you know, you're dealing with between the two areas, you know, well in excess of, you know, probably 10 million people, so you're bound to have interactions, and as our populations of wildlife increase, you're bound to have, you know, more habituation take place and see those animals become more comfortable around people and therefore end up in the burbs at the bird feeder.
And are we seeing more bears in the region anywhere? Is the population growing?
Here in New Jersey, it is, certainly. I can't really speak for Pennsylvania. I know here in New Jersey, we're seeing our population starting to expand its range. You know, we've been seeing a slow movement of bears from northern New Jersey into central and then, you know, even more recently into southern New Jersey. And again, we're not talking a large number of bears, but people are starting to see them, and they're starting to encounter, you know, what bears are all about. So it's a new experience for them. So we're doing our best here in New Jersey to educate them on how to best coexist with them.
Well, I'm curious about what you suggest people do if there have been some black bear sightings outside of Philadelphia. If you see a bear, what, lumbering up your street or in someone's backyard, what should you do?
Well, the best thing to do is just kind of keep your distance. We recommend to folks, if it's your first time experience seeing a bear, you know, notify the local police department. We train a little over 120 police departments now here in the state of New Jersey. It might even be a few more than that. We're always looking to train more to be our first responders. You know, they obviously can get to a location much quicker than we can. You know, they can monitor the animal. They can keep an eye on the situation. And then they always contact us for advice. And then if we need to respond as an agency, that's what we'll do. But you know, the biggest thing is to, you know, just keep your distance. And actually, quite honestly, enjoy the experience because it's a magnificent sight seeing an animal of that size and that capacity, you know, being able to survive in this region.
Are they looking for food and looking for going through our trash cans, things like that?
Bears are always looking for food. They're just like a little Hoover vacuum cleaner when it comes to food. There's nothing that's not on the table for them. Typically, in times when there's less food out there. Right now, actually, is one of those times. It's just before the blueberries are starting to ripen. They'll start working on bird feeders or garbage cans, things of that nature. But once a natural food source does ripen and become available, they'd much rather eat blueberries or, you know, acorns or, you know, whatever is natural out there over garbage anytime.
We had a long and cold winter. Did that have any impact on bear behavior?
It did to a certain degree. You know, I mean, I think like all of us, we all came out of last year's winter a little more cantankerous and probably a little worse for wear. But, you know, as far as the Bears concerned, they probably lost a little bit more weight. Certainly they didn't lose, you know, too much weight. But I'm sure when they came out, they were a little more hungry, which made them a little more interested in finding food. We did have a fairly late spring this year. Things just weren't budding up quite as fast as they normally do. So, you know, for a while there, we had a, especially here in New Jersey, a fairly hard run at, you know, the bird feeders and garbage. And unfortunately, some livestock got eaten as well. So, you know, they're omnivores. If it's available and they think it looks tasty, they're going to eat it.
Are black bears aggressive to humans or even to dogs and cats, things like that?
As a general rule, no. Black bears are very timid. They can be intimidated. But that doesn't mean they aren't capable of being very dangerous as well. Certainly, we don't want to be going up and giving bears bear hugs. You know, that's a definite no-no. But they are, as a general rule, just looking to stay away. They like their own peace and quiet. They're really not interested in, you know, conflict of any kind. About the only time we see those conflicts is when someone steps up or a dog, you know, attacks the bear or something of that nature and the animal's defending itself. That being said, you know, if you do have unprotected livestock, you know, chickens, rabbits, llamas, goats, sheep, things of that nature that, you know, aren't protected, bears are going to capitalize on that. Mm-hmm. And they are predators, and they will kill and eat them.
They climb fences?
They can climb fences. Certain types of fences, you know, your basic cyclone fence that a lot of folks have around their yards, they have no problem climbing over top of that. Taller fences, especially ones with barbed wire at the top, they typically don't climb. It's just too rickety for them. Electric fences, they don't climb because, you know, that fence bites back. So they don't like electric fences. So that's why we recommend folks using electric fences to protect whatever they want bears not to eat.
We got a tweet from Jay said, if humans properly stored their trash, we would reduce unwanted human-bear encounters. Do you agree with that, Kelsey?
That would be accurate. Yep.
Does that mean,
probably,
what does that mean? I mean, like tying it down, or how do you keep the bear out of the trash can?
Well, there's a number of things you can do. There's actually bear-resistant garbage cans out there folks can buy. And we're always encouraging folks to go onto our website and look at those locations. And, you know, if they're willing to spend a little extra money, it makes life a lot simpler for them. but you can store your trash inside your garage. You got to keep the garbage can clean, because even though the garbage can is made out of plastic, it does contain odors. And even the smallest odor that maybe we can't smell as human beings, bears can. So if you're living in bear country or bears are in the area, it does mean you're going to have to be a little bit more prudent when it comes to taking care of food items and trash and your grill. You can't feed the birds. You know, just basic common sense sort of things will make life a lot simpler and better for you.
Well, we're talking about bears making an appearance in the burbs, and that certainly happened here in the Philadelphia area. That's Kelsey Burgess, a principal biologist, Black Bear Project leader with the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. And if you'd like to join our conversation, have any questions or comments for our guest, our phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jody from Lambertville, New Jersey, to join us. Jody, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Kelsey.
Good morning.
Hi. I have a question. I seem to see bears in my area of the state in the springtime only, and I was wondering if there was a correlation to the fawns being born at that time and that the bears come in for a meat source.
Looking to eat a baby deer. Kelsey?
Actually, well, yes and no. Bears do eat fawns, and we have no shortage of deer here in the state of New Jersey, but we don't feel that they're a major predator of fawns. All right, actually, female does are very good at protecting those fawns. Typically, the reason you see bears more in the springtime is because, you know, we're starting to see the breeding season kick in. And females that have yearlings, which are, you know, cubs that they've had for 18 months, then, you know, boot them out of the family home, as it were, Those animals are starting to spread out to look for their home range, their new home, where they're going to spend some time. So that's when you start seeing a lot of these bears show up in cities. You see a lot of media coverage on those. And you also see the big males basically prowling around looking for receptive females to breed with. So it's the springtime is a very active time, and that's why folks see, you know, a lot more bears during this time period.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Jody. And again, you can call as well. If you ever had a question about a bear, this is the place to do it, 1-888-477-9499. Kelsey, I was reading about some of the research that you've been doing in New Jersey where you are, crawling into bear dens while they're hibernating to get a sense of what kind of animals we're dealing with.
We do a lot of research here in New Jersey. We feel that it's very important to keep a very close tab on what our bear population is doing. And, you know, we work very closely with universities and students. You know, we try to make what we do an educational experience for a lot of students because we got to train the, you know, future biologists to take care of this resource. So we really try to be as active as we possibly can in what money allows for. And one of those things that we do is den work every year to keep track of our reproductive status. And what's nice is, you know, we've got, you know, over 40 years of research on our bears here in the state of New Jersey. And, so we really have a long history of really knowing what our population is doing. And because we're a small state, that allows us to do that. Bigger states sometimes can't do that, but we're lucky in that respect.
Well, I was reading about, I guess, you tranquilize the bears, and then you can literally crawl into their den and measure them and see what you're dealing with. I mean, what is that like to do?
Well, if you do it right, it's nice and safe and a lot of fun.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. And here you are, so you obviously are doing it right. Is it cozy warm in there? What is it like inside the den?
Actually, the dens are very warm. A lot of folks have got the stereotypic thought that bears live in caves and it's a big open cave and, you know, there's a lot of space. And if you think about that, that really doesn't make a lot of sense because big open caves are going to be, you know, much cooler, much damper. You know, you can't control the temperature inside that cave. But so a bear, the average opening size for a bear cave, as it were, is only 15 inches across.
Wow.
And even the biggest bear we have in New Jersey can fit in a hole that size, because they don't have a collarbone like humans do. So as long as the head goes in the hole, the rest of the body can squeeze in there too. And the less airspace that's in there, the warmer they can make it. And they're very good at making a nice, cozy, warm bed. They use grass and leaves and twigs. And we even got bears making homes underneath people's homes, making dens underneath people's homes and porches. And as long as they're out of the wind and out of the, you know, basic elements of the rain, you know, they can do really, really well.
That's great. Let me get Joe from Montgomery Township to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there, Joe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question about the legality of bear spray in New Jersey. I know pepper spray over, I think, a quarter ounce would be illegal. But I am doing a lot of hiking this summer with my dog, and I was just wondering about the legality of bear spray in New Jersey. And then I have a story to share about an encounter my dog and I had with a bear in November. I had him off-leash in a big, big, open, preserved area where I take him to run, and we rounded a corner, and about 25 yards from us was a big black bear, and my dog charged at it. And I called him back, and thank goodness he came back to me, and I got him on the leash. And the bear stood up on its hind legs, looked at us, and I started to walk back to the car, and the bear kind of was going in the same direction we were. But thankfully, I got the dog back in the car, and the bear just kind of looked at us again and just kind of went on his way.
Where were you, Joe?
There's a huge open space where I live in Montgomery, and that's where I have a very active dog, and he's big, and I just take him to run so he can get all his energy spent. And it was early in the morning. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. So it was near the Sourland Mountains, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, it's quite an encounter. Kelsey, your thoughts?
Well, that's typical, actually. I'll address the first issue or first question you had about the legality of the pepper spray.
Right.
Residents are allowed to carry only a 1-ounce container size of it. That does not mean folks aren't getting a hold of bigger containers of it out there, which is technically illegal. I'm not sure how law enforcement really views that, because it depends on your township and in which law enforcement officer you run across on any given day. But from our standpoint as an agency, we don't use pepper spray because black bears have a mucosal membrane around their nose and their eyes that essentially make the pepper spray ineffective. So we don't even use it anymore. It works much better on grizzly bears. But for black bears, all you're really doing is feeding them an appetizer of Taco Bell. So it's really not worth the money to even spend on it in the first place. The second...
the encounter, yeah.
The encounter itself, that's pretty typical. Black bears are very, very curious animals. Once they stand up on their hind legs, that's a sign of curiosity for them. They're just trying to get a better look at you. And it's not atypical for them to, you know, walk towards a person or their dog only just to get a better look at you or, you know, just kind of see what's going on. So, I mean, they were absolutely in no danger at that point in time. The bear was just, you know, basically trying to find out who they were and, you know, what they were doing in his neighborhood at that point. So if the bear dropped down on all fours and began charging at him, you know, then it's a different story.
And we're almost out of time here. A related email, if a bear spots a cyclist riding away from it, will they instinctively chase the bear? Kelsey, we're almost out of time. Is there a quick answer to that?
I've never had it happen in New Jersey, but that's not to say it can't.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, helping us understand the bears that are wandering into the suburbs of Philadelphia and other parts of the country as well. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Kelsey Burgess, principal biologist and black bear project leader with the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. And you can carry on a conversation we started in the first portion of Radio Times, going to our Facebook page, and you can leave a comment on our homepage as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.